Welcome to the second Teach and Retire Rich podcast of 2015. My name is Dan Otter. I'm a teacher. I'm the author of the book Teach and Retire Rich, and I run the website 403bwise.com. I'm joined today, as always, with my good friend and certified financial planner, Scott Downhower, whose financial firm is called Meridian Wealth. How you doing, Scott?
Doing great, Dan. Thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm doing really good. How are things in sunny Southern California?
They are still sunny. We had a little bit of spring weather, meaning we got down to the 70s.
Oh my God!
But we're in the mid 80s, almost 90 this week. But we may get some rain next week, maybe.
Well, I hope that does happen, given your water issues. So we had a freeze warning this morning in Albuquerque. It got down to 34 degrees. I had to turn my sprinklers off, make sure they didn't go on early in the morning. Actually, just got done with a great mountain bike ride. As you know, I live in the foothills just below the Sandias, and it was windy, blustery, cold. Looks like it could even snow up in the Sandias. So anyway, that's what's going on here. California, always perfect weather. All right, Scott. Well, as you know, today we're going to discuss teacher pension plans. Among the questions we will address are, what are they? How do they work? What happens if you move from one state to another? What happens if you leave teaching? And can you purchase years or credit? So those will be some of the questions we address. But before we get into that, Scott, it's the feature we introduced last week. And I shamelessly stole it from the Men in Blazers podcast. These two guys talk about soccer, but before they do, they each open up a Guinness. So what we're doing is we each have a micro beer, and we're going to go ahead and describe what our beer is, open it up, and then we'll get into the podcast. Scott, what do you have today?
Dan, today I've got what I'll call a local beer. It's out in Redlands, California. We had talked about it last week. I don't know about it on the show, but it's called Hangar 24. And I've got their orange wheat. This is actually my favorite Hangar 24 beer. It's actually one of my favorite beers overall. Very good, a little rich, can't drink too many of them. But that actually kind of works in my favor, especially on a Friday afternoon.
Yes, I agree. Well, Scott, great minds think alike. I also have a wheat beer. I have Wildflower Wheat from Marble Brewery. And it's interesting, inscribed on the bottle, it says, punctiliously brewed in Albuquerque, New Mexico, USA. And Scott, do you know what punctiliously means?
I have no idea what that means.
Neither do I. So I actually looked it up, did a little show research here. Extremely attentive to punctilios, strict or exact in the observance of the formalities or amenities of conduct or actions. So, Scott, are you punctilious in any aspects of your life?
Just in the spreadsheets I develop for clients.
Okay. Good answer, my friend. All right, before I open this up, I'll just add that they say on their website, enjoy with this particular brew, enjoy with green chili enchiladas, squash blossoms, bands in the park, sundresses. So I think I could do three of the four, but not four of the four there.
Oh,
all right, Scott,
come on, yeah.
Let's go ahead and open these up. I think we did that at the same time. Nice. Cheers to you.
Cheers.
That is a good beer. Nice summer beer. Always, the wheat beer is always a good choice. All right, Scott. So we're talking today about really, I would call it the core savings plan for teachers. These are pension plans. How would you describe a pension plan? What is a pension plan?
Well, I mean, a pension plan is basically, it's a savings plan where you, the employee, contribute out of every paycheck. You're automatically enrolled to it. So as soon as you sign on the dotted line, money starts coming out of your paycheck. Typically, the employer also contributes to it. And you contribute to it your entire life, your entire work life. And when you retire, you essentially get an income stream that you can't outlive. So a pension is really an income stream that you can't outlive. It takes many different forms, but at its base, it's really just an income stream that you can't outlive.
And I think for a lot of teachers, that's a very appealing aspect of the profession, right? You know, they might not completely understand how this works, but the idea that you're covered by this, and as you pointed out, it's automatic, you're automatically enrolled, and you're not making any investment decisions, right? It's not like as a teacher, you're choosing where to invest your pension. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's very simple. All you do is, you know, become employed, and everything is done on everything else is done for you. It's a little unique these days to have a pension, you know, and it's unique for someone to actually stay, you know, at the same job for, you know, that many years to actually make a pension meaningful. And teaching is one of those employment opportunities where if you can stay in it, you know, a lot of teachers who stay in it for 5 years will usually stay in it for, you know, the rest of their career. As you've experienced, you see a lot of turnover of people in the first 5 years of teaching. But, you know, for those who end up staying in it for the long run, it can be a very, very nice benefit and certainly is one of the major tiers of their retirement planning.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And so the way it works then is, how is it funded? Who funds a pension plan?
Well, it really depends. For the most part, it's funded partially by the employee. Contributions usually as a percentage of their pay come out of their paycheck. And then the employer also contributes. And sometimes, when we're talking about government plans, sometimes you'll have contributions that also come from the state also.
Yeah, and so it's often described as a formula-based plan. And the formula is typically how much you make and then your years of service. And then when you reach eligibility, and we can discuss what that means, you then get a percentage of your salary until death. And Scott, would you say generally across the country, if somebody teaches 25 to 30 years, would you say in most cases it would range between maybe 60% to 80% of their final salary? Would that be a good ballpark?
I think so. I think it partially depends on what type of state they're in. We'll be talking about it later, whether or not they could also contribute to Social Security. You know, if you live in a state where you also contribute to Social Security, your pension contributions are going to be smaller than if you're in a state that doesn't contribute to Social Security. And so your pension is also going to be smaller. But the whole point of it is the pension plus your Social Security should get you to the 60 to 85% of your final salary.
Yeah, I guess we should just jump into that question because I think a lot of people find this surprising. You know, these plans vary from state to state, 50 states, but what was the number of states that if you contribute to a teacher pension plan, you are not part of Social Security?
Well, from the NEA website, the National Education Association, they list 15 states that are currently not covered by Social Security. And there are some local governments within those states that are, but there are at least 15 states that have some employees that are not covered by Social Security. And I live here in California, and public employees, specifically teachers, are not covered by Social Security. They don't pay into it.
What does that mean to an employee? Is it better to be in a state, do you think, that you also get Social Security, or is it better to be in a state like California where when you contribute to their pension plan, which is called CalSTRS, which stands for California State Teachers Retirement System, is that a better way to be?
Well, I think there are pros and cons to both. You know, living in a state where you have both Social Security and a pension plan versus a state where you just have the state's pension plan, I think the benefit of having both, you know, including Social Security, say you have some diversification in your income streams. And if you are having difficulties or if your pension plan is maybe underfunded and it's having some difficulties, you have this secondary source that's going to back you up in Social Security. Social Security also has some very, very good inflation benefits to it. It also has some good spousal benefits and survivor benefits that a state pension might not have. With that said, Some state pensions are very generous. You know, you may pay a lot into it, but you also have a very generous monthly benefit that might be more than if you were in a state that had the two. So it does kind of depend. And it is nice to have a diversification of income streams, you know, in case one is faltering, you still have that backup. You're not fully reliant on just that state. But it really does depend on the state. Some are more generous than others.
Yeah, I would encourage anyone listening to whatever state you're in, go to the website for your plan. And I've yet to see a state-based plan that doesn't include lots of great online information, retirement calculators, where you can go ahead and do some assumptions. You know, let's say you're 6 years in and you're deciding, or let's say even 5 years, Scott, because as you mentioned, that seems to be the number where we lose teachers. And if they stay beyond five, then they stay in this career much longer. But let's say you're contemplating that. And I would think, you know, compensation and retirement plan might be a factor in your decision whether to stay or not. You can go to your state's website, and usually they have a calculator available, and you can plug in assumptions. Let's say you stay 25, 30 years. What kind of retirement payout can you expect to get? So I would encourage people to go and become familiar with that. And I would say the earlier you can, the better. You know, don't wait till you're 2 years from retirement before doing this. You know, I'm in New Mexico, and this is a state. If you are a teacher here, you get you pay into Social Security and into the New Mexico retirement plan, which is called the NMERB, New Mexico Educational Retirement Board. And just sort of looking at some of the numbers, if you are a teacher here, you would contribute 10.7%, and then the state puts in 13.9%. So is Social Security about 6%, would you say, Scott, that employee contributes?
Yeah, Social Security is 6.2%, and the employer also contributes 6.2%.
So, you know, as an employee, you know, just take New Mexico, for example, because that's where I live, you know, basically 17% of your salary is going to retirement plans right off the bat. And as you mentioned, it's automatic, you know, it's just part of being employed. Do you want to talk about California a little bit, since it's such a big state? You know, just real roughly, what do employees contribute and what does the employer contribute?
Yeah, sure. Well, in the good old days, which ended about 2 years ago, it was pretty simple. It was the employee contributed 8%, so the teacher contributed 8% of their paycheck, the employer 8.25%, and I think the state kicked in a couple percent as well. And what was also cool about of that 8% that the employee kicked in, 2% of that actually went to a separate account that was kind of like a 403B. It was a separate account that would earn interest and that they could just take out at retirement. It's called a defined benefit supplement. It's pretty neat. But as you know, we've had some economic woes in the past decade. The financial crisis hit pretty hard, and the plans became underfunded. Meaning, so when a plan is underfunded, it means there's not enough assets over the long run to pay out the liabilities. So they got to pay out more money than they have what they think they're going to generate. So in order to get that funding back up to close that gap, they needed to increase contributions from really everywhere. There is a couple things that they did. The first thing they did is they created two tiers of members. So instead of everybody having the exact same formula for retirement, they took the people who are currently teaching and let them keep their formula. And then anybody hired after December 31st, 2012, they actually got a different formula for calculating their benefits. And it's a little bit lower, so the benefits aren't as good as they were under the previous plan. We call that kind of a second tier. The other thing that's different is now contributions are higher. So where they were 8%, this year they're 8.15%. Next year, next school year, they'll go up to 9.2%. And then the school year after that, they'll rise to 10.25%. The second tier has a similar structure as well. But what's really interesting is that the employer who was contributing 8.25%, that rate by 2020, 2021 is going to go up to 19.1%. So
that's a huge number, Scott.
It is a huge number. So, I mean, think about it. In 2020, 2021, my wife's going to have 10.25% of her paycheck going to CalSTRS, and the employer is going to kick in another 19.1%. And then the state, they were contributing 5%. They're going to contribute 8.8%. I mean, those are some big numbers. I mean, of her pay, I mean, you know, that definitely is some big numbers to look at. 10.25, 19.1, and 8.828. That's fully 38% of pay.
That does not seem sustainable. My only guess is that they knew when they came up with these new rules that the state was going to run out of water, okay? And then maybe they'd have to shut it down by then.
I think what's going on, Dan, is CalSTRS has been hoarding water for a long, long time. They're going to have to use it to pay pension benefits.
You know,
they're going to be able to sell
this. They're located next to a river, right, in Sacramento. And did I see them damming that thing up the last time I was there?
Yeah, and pretty soon there's going to be CalSTRS spring water that you'll be able to buy. It will fund pensions for many years to come.
$5 a bottle. That's funny. Oh my gosh. Wow. And, you know, and I think this is part of a larger trend nationally as, you know, legislators are looking a little more critically at pension solvency. These are the kind of ideas that I think are spreading all around the country. And I think the bottom line is employees are going to be paying more, employers are going to be paying more. And, you know, what does this mean for future raises, right? For if you're a teacher in California, you know, where are those going to come from?
Yeah, and you had mentioned in a previous conversation, you know, it's not like healthcare costs are dropping. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have healthcare costs also going up and these other benefits going up, it's going to be difficult. I think raises, we may not see a lot of raises, maybe, you know, in the next few years during the adjustment, but going forward, it's going to be tough, at least here in California.
I think so, yeah. I think these changes will just continue to happen. Well, let's get into some of the kind of nuts and bolts here as far as, you know, what happens if you move to a different state? So you've taught in California, let's say 7 or 8 years, you want to continue teaching and you've heard that the state is running out of water. So you're going to move to Oregon, one of your favorite states, because you hear there's a lot of water up there. What would that mean to your pension if you were to move from California to, let's say, Oregon or Washington?
Well, that's a good question, Dan, and I hope someday to find that out. No, I'd love to convince my – I married a San Diego girl, and she is not moving to Oregon, so we'll be collecting a CalSTRS pension.
Wow.
But we may be spending some of that money in Oregon.
Okay.
So essentially what happens is your pension – and there's a few things that can happen. Your pension basically gets frozen as is, assuming you've put in enough years. You continue to accrue your pension. So the formula that's in place when you start will still be in place. You'll have the years of service times however old you are when you actually retire times your ending salary. If you have left employment here in California, your salary isn't going up anymore because you don't have one. So they're going to base your salary on what your salary was the day you left. And they actually have a different kind of a more intense formula for that, but just to make it easy, we'll say your ending salary when you left. The one part of the formula that is increasing is your age. So you're getting older, you actually get your benefit gets a little bit bigger just by getting older. So there is one benefit to getting older. just one.
Wisdom,
but what
Scott,
happens?
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yes. Wisdom and your age factor. So when you go to Oregon, you start a brand new pension there, and you're going to essentially accrue two different pensions, your Oregon pension and your California pension. There are some – in some cases, there is the ability to basically leave your pension here in California, take a distribution from your pension in California, and buy into a pension in another state. there is the possibility for that. Every state has a different method for doing that. It doesn't always work very well, and you may leave some money on the table by doing that. So you really have to take a look at both to see whether or not, number one, it makes sense to leave your pension from the prior state, meaning take a distribution from it and try to just have one pension. It doesn't always really work out that well. But it definitely makes sense to look at both pensions and see whether or not they have a provision that will let you buy into the new one. We're starting to see less and less of that. Mm. Now, sometimes with, I know you didn't ask this question, but sometimes within the same state, you move to a different job that you actually change pension systems. If you're a California teacher and you're working for a school district, you're going to be in the same school system, the same pension, CalSTRS. But let's say you become a university professor instead, where you're not in the CalSTRS pension. You're going to be in perhaps the UC system's pension. Well, they have something called reciprocity. And what that allows you to do is actually you still maintain your pension with CalSTRS. You start a new pension with the UC system. But when you retire, you actually retire at the same time from both systems. And you're able to use the salary, your final salary at your UC system age for both pensions.
Wow, that seems like quite a benefit.
It's a huge benefit. So let's say you spent 15 years in a CalSTRS covered employment and then another 15 years at UC. Well, your CalSTRS covered employment was at that salary from 15 years ago. But if you go through this what's called concurrent retirement and reciprocity, you're able to use your UC salary to calculate that CalSTRS benefit. So within the state, there are some better options. Going outside the state, it gets a little more difficult. You may end up with two separate pensions.
Scott, I think that information is going to lead to some teachers listening to this podcast quitting teaching and then going to work for the UC system. So we have just added to teacher attrition with that piece of information, I think.
Well, I don't think it's that easy to get a job in the UC system, so we might be okay.
That is probably true. So I guess, as you alluded to, I think probably the smartest thing, anyone listening now who maybe is contemplating a move, get as much information now before you make the move. Look at your current system. Look at the system you might be going into. So, Scott, if you're, let's just say again, in California, you've got 7 or 8 years, you're moving up to Oregon to be a teacher, most likely you're going to just maintain the CalSTRS plan. It'll stay as it is, and you'll be able to tap that when you reach retirement age.
Yeah, that's right. Although a mistake, I'll say it a mistake, a lot of people make is they have this option when they leave their California employment to actually take a distribution of the money that they put in. So, yeah, as we alluded to earlier, you're putting in 8 to 10% of your paycheck into this plan, and they actually keep track of that money and they add interest to that money. And if you were to leave employment, you could take a distribution of that money. You could take a distribution, it's taxable, you could spend it, hopefully you won't do that, or you could roll it over to an IRA. And a lot of people do that. But what they don't realize is by doing that, they're giving up the portion that was contributed by their employer and by the state. And it very well may be that by leaving their benefits there at the state in that pension, they could end up with a much higher benefit than they would have if they had taken that money out, rolled it to an IRA, and invested it themselves. So they need to take a really hard look before they do that.
Well, Scott, that's kind of a perfect segue because I did exactly that. And I don't think we had this discussion before I did this. In 2000, I had taught for 8 years in California, and I rolled over my my portion of my contribution into CalSTRS. It was 8 years, and I rolled it into a a rollover IRA, so it stayed within that tax sheltered plan. But I think it that's when I found out that I was losing the employer contribution. And I want to say it was about $45,000, and it's only about $100,000 now. And I really think about that I probably should have left it where it's at. I had gone to the website, done some calculations, and I forget what pushed me over to make that decision. But I think I could be an example here where I probably should have left it where it's at.
Well, you know, in 2000, we had just finished one of the greatest, actually the greatest bull market in the history of markets, probably. We had 5+ years of 20+% returns in the stock market. All you had to do, kind of like today, just throw some money in the market. It'll go up. You'll make money. Tech stocks were going crazy. You know, 10% returns were easy. And so I think a lot of people thought, hey, I'm going to do a lot better investing this on my own than what I could get from a pension. But I do have some good news for you. it's not great news, but maybe it'll get you back here to California where we can hang out a little bit more. You can come back and work as a school teacher here in California, Dan, if you like. And you can rejoin the CalSTRS plan, and they will let you buy back the years of service that you had taken out. Hmm. Now, the one hitch is that they are going to, so whatever the amount that you took out, they're going to do this calculation to see how much they would have earned on that money had they kept the money and invested it between 2000 and now 2015. And that's the amount that you would have to redeposit into your account in order to restore your benefits.
Interesting.
So there is, you know, you could restore your benefits by moving back here and becoming a teacher and get those years back. And I mean, obviously, we'd have to run some calculations to see if it was worth it, but it very well may be.
Well, Scott, I think this little incident is a perfect example why you would want to employ the services of someone like yourself.
Yes.
You get similar questions like this from people, from your clients.
Oh yeah, all the time. And you know, usually in these situations, I just create a little spreadsheet and, you know, we just run the numbers to see what it looks like. And I, you know, for those situations, I usually just charge an hourly fee, and it's very simple. It's a one-time thing. It's not like an ongoing issue. So it's something we can do pretty quickly, and I've got a lot of experience in doing it. So it's a pretty simple spreadsheet to do. But having said that, usually there are counselors at the defined benefit or the pension plan that will sit down with you and help you with that as well. They'll run numbers for you as well. They don't necessarily always know, they may not always have the best equipment to do the necessary calculations, but a lot of them are pretty good at what they do, and they can help you also.
And it's not like they are commission-based representatives, right, who have an interest in either you leaving the system or staying in the system. They're typically salaried and generally should have your best interests in mind.
Yeah, ironically, they are selling an annuity, but they just don't get paid commissions for it.
That's funny. Scott, you touched on a concept called buying back service credit or, you know, buying years of service. What does that mean? And let's say it's not the situation I described. I guess it most likely would be. Or if you are, let's say you've continuously taught in California for 20 years, can you buy more years?
Well, you know, a lot of that's changed, and it's changing in a lot of states. Part of this funding the gap here in California was removing some of the ability to purchase service credit. So you used to be able to buy service credit pretty easily. Now it's a little more difficult, but it can still be done. When I first started in financial planning, the cost to buy back service credit was extremely low. And I think this is kind of one of the benefits of working with someone who is a fiduciary.
Do you want to define that term? What is a fiduciary?
So a fiduciary is someone who is
punctilious.
In some respects. Yeah. Those two terms are you could ask either one of those terms and most people wouldn't be able to define them. So I that would actually be a good man on the street question. So a fiduciary is someone who is required to work in your best interest. They have to put your interests ahead of their own. And when working with money, that's a pretty important feature, I think. You want someone who is working in your best interest and going to do what's best for you as opposed to what makes them the most money. And in buying back service credit, doing those calculations, a lot of times, and I know this will be a follow-up question, a lot of times buying back that service credit is going to have to come from existing cash, you know, money that's in an IRA or a 403B or something along those lines. And typically that means taking money out of a product that has been sold to you. And agents, insurance agents, don't like to do that. They also don't like you directing new money towards the CalSTRS system to buy back service credit when you could be directing new money to a product that pays them a commission, right? So, you know, back when I first started, the rates were really small to buy back service credit, and you could buy back all sorts of different service credit. So people would come to me and I would run numbers and I would show them how much their pension plan would increase by buying back service credit. And Dan, the numbers were amazing. I mean, the return on investment, they were just obscene. And I remember going, oh my gosh, why would anybody invest in a 403B when they could buy these service credits? It was phenomenal. And eventually, CalSTRS realized that they were giving away, I mean, basically just giving away money. And they changed the numbers to make it much more similar to what their actual cost is. So it's no longer a slam dunk. But to answer your question, there are a couple different types of service credit. Essentially what we refer to as permissive service credit. And this is service credit to buy back years that perhaps, you know, like you took a distribution from years that you had taught. So you're able to buy those years back. You might have taken time off for maternity leave, and so you're able to buy those years back. And there's certain years that are qualified that allow you to buy back. So essentially years that you would have been teaching but you weren't, you can buy those back. And then there is what they call airtime. So it's what they would call airtime. And airtime is service credit that is completely unrelated to years that you have put in. And anybody could buy up to a certain number of years in airtime. In California, I think you could buy up to 5 years. It's basically like buying a deferred annuity. You put your money in, it grows, and then at retirement, they pay you out an income for life. That airtime was never an amazing deal. It was just a decent deal. But the permissive service credit was always a very good deal. It's not an amazing deal now, but it is still something that I run calculations for teachers 2, 3, 4, 5 times a year to see if it makes sense to buy back service credit. And depending on their situation, it still might make sense. So it's definitely something people should be looking at.
And Scott, you mentioned a term, 403B, and I know that's not the topic today on this podcast, but that will definitely be a topic, probably our next podcast. And that is a supplemental plan and supplemental to a pension, and it works very much like a 401k. I'm going to guess that a lot of people listening to this have only heard the term TSA in reference to what a 403B is. You know, they've heard the term TSA, which stands for tax sheltered annuity, but we will get into that most likely into the next podcast. So in case you're not sure what that term is, you can go to my website, 403BWise, to learn about that, but we will definitely cover that in future podcasts. So Scott, just to kind of wrap up here, the talk about pensions. Okay, you're a teacher, you've taught 25, 30 years is, you know, when can you begin to access money? When can you retire and start getting that payout?
It really depends on the system. You can typically retire as long as you have 5 years of service and attain some age, usually age 50. But you should be very careful. The earlier you retire, the smaller your benefit's going to be. And that's because the earlier you retire, the more years you have to live. So the benefit needs to be smaller. And they also want to incentivize you to work longer. So the longer you stay in your job, the more you're going to get in pension benefit. But generally, it's somewhere around age 60 is where we see a lot of teachers beginning to retire, a lot of people, a lot of school employees starting to retire. So I get a lot of people at 55, 56, 57 coming to me and wanting to know how quickly they can retire. And generally, I see it around 60 to 65, although my son, his teacher is 72, 72 years old and still teaching. And literally, he could retire and make more money than he does teaching, and yet he's still teaching.
Scott, let's get him on.
We should.
Do you think he would do this? I mean, you get so many, you know, you hear so much about teachers burning out, teachers quitting after 5 years. This would be, I think, a pretty interesting person to speak with.
He would be. And what I love about him is his passion for teaching writing. He took my son from, you know, a kid who hated writing. I mean, hated it. It would take him 2 hours to write a paragraph. And he was a seventh grader at the time. And now, you know, he'll spit out a whole essay in, you know, a half hour, 40 minutes. And that's after just 6 months with this guy. So I'm glad he stuck around and didn't collect that pension.
Well, you know, and I'll touch on this probably in later podcasts. And this hopefully doesn't sound like too shameless of a plug. But, you know, my book is called Teach and Retire Rich. And the premise is not retiring with millions of dollars. It's retiring comfortably after having done a profession that you really enjoy, that's intrinsically rewarding. And that's the rich part of it. And I think someone like this, I would love to spotlight, because I think we need some more role models. I know in this state, the testing requirements, the way teachers are being assessed is becoming increasingly based on one standardized test. I think we are making an unbelievably amazing profession more and more difficult. And so the more stories like this we can get out, I think the better. So that's great to hear. So Scott, with taking your money out, like you say, generally about 60 years, 62 years old, you know, teaching 25 to 30 years is going to probably give you a pretty nice core for retirement. I happen to have in front of me the latest CalSTRS retirement information. So in the year 2014, 10,736 teachers retired, and their median age was 62.3, which is right along with what you were saying, and their median years of service, which is, you know, how long they were teachers, is 24.7 years, and their average members-only benefit is $3,939. Scott, my question for you is, first of all, what do you think of those kind of numbers and that type of benefit for retirement? And then also, what does members-only benefit mean?
Well, in terms of those numbers, I think, you know, it really depends on where you're retiring, what your lifestyle is. You know, is your house paid off? You know, $4,000 a month can be a lot of money, but remember, there's taxes. Here in California, there's pretty heavy state taxes, pretty heavy property taxes, pretty heavy sales taxes. I'm really making the case for California, aren't I? So, you know, $4,000 a month may not, you know, go as far as if you're living in, I don't know, Nevada or Arizona or New Mexico, maybe.
Exactly, yeah. And there's also no thing to keep in mind, there's no Social Security.
Right. And in fact, and that's another topic we'll get into on another podcast, is Social Security and how it interacts with the pension. But there may be a Social Security benefit that they won't actually get. So, you know, it really depends. I mean, you can definitely retire in California on $4,000 a month if you've done your work in addition to that, or if you live a pretty reasonable lifestyle. But you definitely need to do some planning. Your second question, what's a members-only benefit?
Yeah, is that a jacket? I remember those members-only jackets. Is that what
I knew you were going to say that.
Does CalSTRS send you that as a, like a retired?
Yeah. Instead of a watch, you get this jacket, and it's really cool. So, like, you know, whenever you're walking around and you see someone with a members-only jacket, you know they're a teacher.
It actually means they don't care about their spouse, right?
Actually, yeah. So members only. So when you take a pension, you have a few different options, and the very first option is what they what they call the members only, or it's the life only option. And so that's the amount of money that they are going to pay you over your life only. So if you're a single teacher and you're retiring, that's the benefit you'll likely take. And so they will pay you, as long as you're alive, they're going to pay you that $4,000 a month. There's some inflation.
Does it go up for inflation?
It does. That's why don't we come back to that one, because there is some inflation adjustment as well. But you're going to get that as long as you're alive. So that's great. But what if you have a spouse in California? You know, what if you're married? So if you have a spouse, you can actually provide a benefit to your spouse as well, or other loved one, and so they will structure a benefit that lasts over a joint lifetime. So as long as either one of you are alive, you will continue to get that benefit. And the advantage there is that, you know, maybe the teacher dies early and you don't want that benefit to die with them. You need that benefit to continue for the spouse. So the CalSTRS calls it the 100% option, so meaning you get the same benefit as long as either one of the spouses are alive. In insurance parlance, it's called the joint lifetime income. And essentially, you take a reduction in your pension in order to provide this lifetime benefit for both of you. And that reduction it's going to depend on the age of your spouse. So if your spouse is older than you, it'll be a smaller reduction. If your spouse is younger than you, it'll be a bigger reduction. And generally, it's anywhere from 8 to 12% reduction in your monthly benefit. I almost always advise my clients to do that. Very rare occasions do I tell them not to. And in California, here's a little secret. In California, once you turn 55, you can elect what they call pre-elect an option. So you can pre-elect to provide a benefit to your spouse for life. And by doing that, you actually lock in a lower reduction. So I'll give you a quick example. Hopefully this won't be complicated. But if you wait until you retire, say age 62, that reduction to provide for your spouse might be 10%. Okay, so a $4,000 benefit becomes $3,600. Well, if you pre-elect at 55, instead of a 10% reduction, it might be a 6% reduction. So you actually get a higher benefit by pre-electing. It's very strange. You don't actually see that in many pensions. So if you're a California teacher, when you turn 55, if you're sure you're going to be married to the same person for retirement, you should consider pre-electing a retirement benefit. But yeah, these pension benefits can be structured in different ways to provide for a spousal benefit. I even have a client who's actually going to their joint benefit is going to be with their daughter. Take a very big cut to do that.
Sure.
But it's kind of unique. It's the only client I have that's done that. But you can provide a benefit to just about anybody if you're willing to take that reduction.
Wow. Now, was this client's spouse deceased?
No, actually, they're not. But he totally agreed with it. They had enough money to do that. It's not for everybody.
Sure. That definitely sounds like an outlier. And again, I know you're not familiar with every state. Would you say that similar provisions exist in other states as far as that members only or
Yeah, I've never come across a pension that didn't offer some sort of ability to provide for a spouse as well. The one thing I would caution is, you know, people look at this reduction and they get very nervous. Like, well, boy, I'm going to have a problem living on $4,000. I certainly can't live on $3,600. And so they assume that they're going to be the one who beats the odds. You know, I'm going to outlive my spouse. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. It's a pretty big risk to take for such a small reduction. But what I want to say is there are some people out there who sell products and will tell you, listen, I've got a way for you to take that member-only benefit and still provide for your spouse. So you get the benefit of the higher income. And what they do is they sell you a life insurance policy. Mm. And they make the numbers look really pretty and really nice. And they sell you this life insurance policy that's supposed to protect your spouse. From experience, I can tell you, it almost never works. I'm sure there's situations where it does, but the way they're usually structured and the numbers that are run by the agents are usually, they're usually just completely incompetent. So if you ever come across what's called pension maximization or someone trying to sell you insurance instead of taking a spousal survivor benefit, go meet with a fee-only financial planner who has no interest in selling you products to see if it does make sense. They'll be honest with you. They'll tell you whether it makes sense or not. It usually doesn't.
I was going to add, I'm guessing these people are not fiduciaries, Scott.
No, they're not. And you know, they're interested in selling products and generating commissions. And a lot of the times, they're not bad people. They are just people who have been who've got into a sales profession. They're told, this is what you do, this is how you do it, and you're helping these teachers. You're helping. They think they're doing them a favor. But when you run the numbers, it just doesn't work out. And I've had several clients sold this strategy, and we had to essentially get them out of it. I had one client where it would have completely devastated their retirement had they done this. Yeah. And luckily, I saved them before we got to retirement. So it's very important that if you're involved in some type of scheme like this, that you have somebody check it out before you retire.
Oh, Scott, that's great information. Again, this is the reason we got into what we both do here. But, you know, I go back to, where were you helping me, you know, 12 years ago when I took my money out of CalSTRS, you know?
Well, you know, I think we had just met.
I don't think I talked to you.
2000 or 2001.
Well, what's funny is I definitely want to do a podcast on our biggest mistakes. And maybe mine will be longer. They'll be more in length than yours. But I think that would be a kind of a fun thing to show that, you know, even though we're interested in this stuff, we have definitely made our fair share of mistakes. So Scott, I would just, you know, let's just wrap up this discussion on pensions by, is there anything else anyone folks should know about pension plans that maybe we didn't cover?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot, but the one thing that you had touched on and I did want to come back to was inflation.
Okay.
You know, the big problem with pensions is that even though they provide you an income for life, a lot of times that income stays the same every year. So if they're retiring with a $4,000 a year benefit and their expenses are $3,500 a year, that's great. They've got extra money every month. But what happens is we have this thing called inflation. So it eats away at your purchasing power. The goods and services that you can buy with that pension initially get fewer and fewer and fewer as the years go by. So inflation eats into our expenses, and it eats into that pension. If that pension doesn't also grow, then you're eventually going to have more expenses than you have income. And so you want to, when you're getting into a pension or if you're deciding whether or not you want to get out of a pension, you need to look at the inflation what they call cost of living adjustments that come with these pensions. They're very important. Social Security is fully adjusted for inflation. Whatever inflation does, it's going to go up. It's not that case with a lot of government pensions. However, most of them have some sort of inflation adjustment, and you want to be aware of what that is, especially because if you do your planning in advance and you know what that inflation adjustment is, then you know whether or not you need to start saving in a supplemental account prior to retirement in order to combat that inflation.
And, you know, we've been in a period of historically low inflation, wouldn't you say, the past 5 to 7 years, perhaps? And I think it's very unlikely that that continues.
Well, you know, I really don't know. It's tough to say. Japan has been stuck with extreme low inflation for almost 20 years. I mean, they have almost zero inflation. The interest rates on their bonds are extremely low. I mean, ours are low, but not as low as theirs. We have Europe entering into a kind of deflationary or disinflationary environment. You know, the interest rates on German bonds are negative up to like 13 years. There are mortgages in Europe where the bank is actually paying a little bit of principal every year because of these negative interest rates. So, you know, I don't know. I tend to think over time we're going to see inflation. That's certainly the goal of the Federal Reserve, and you should definitely protect your portfolio as if you're going to have inflation. But who knows what will happen in the next 5 or 10 years.
Sure. Well, very good information. Let's jump to three questions, Scott.
All right.
It's a feature where we each have prepared three questions for the other person, and you have not seen my questions that I have for you, and I've not seen your questions you have for me. So do you want to go first, or would you like me to start first with the asking of the question?
Why don't you go first asking the question?
Okay. All right, Scott, Jimmy McGill or Saul Goodman?
Well, boy, well, you know, Saul Goodman is so much fun.
Uh-huh.
I love him. I mean, he's like, but he's also a crook. I mean, he's the exact opposite of, you know, he is that caricature of the slimy annuity agent. You know, he's not a fiduciary. Well, let me take this back. I know I shouldn't talk this long on this question, but he actually is the ultimate fiduciary. He loves Walter White, and he will do anything for him. And his client is Walter White, and he's going to protect him, right? So he, in that sense, he is a fiduciary, but he's also a total crook. But I loved Jimmy because he was such a good guy, and he just kind of went the wrong way. But he tried. He picked himself up. He went to law school, but then he turned into Saul. So I don't know. Saul's more entertaining, but I think Jimmy was great at heart.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I love the character of Saul Goodman. I mean, he is, in my mind, one of the best characters ever on television. But Jimmy McGill, I mean, the guy loves his brother. All he did for his brother, you pull for this guy. So, yeah, I have to agree with you on that one, Scott. All right, your turn.
All right, moving from different entertainment, from the movie or the TV shows to music, the Rolling Stones or the Beatles?
Oh, wow. For me, this is actually kind of, I'm a huge Rolling Stones fan. I read some books on them when I was in college, and it was funny, I was going through my total punk phase. I'm a huge Sex Pistols fan, probably my favorite band of all time. But I got this book called Up and Down with the Rolling Stones, and it was written by Keith Richards' drug supplier. And just the stories of these guys, you know, in many ways they were the punk rockers for their time. You know, Mick Jagger, I think, got jailed. I think it was like he or Keith Richards were public urination they got jailed for. But they really sort of crossed some lines for their time. You know, I think obviously the Beatles, probably, you know, the greatest band ever. But for me, if you were to, you know, the old Stuck on a Desert Island, I would definitely pick Rolling Stones songs. So anyway, good. I like that question.
All right.
My turn here. All right, Scott, we'll try to make this a little financial here. Rent or buy? And I know there's obviously a lot of factors when it comes to that. And we'll make this around the topic of housing.
Okay. Well, I mean, for me, that question revolves around price and, you know, length of stay, you know. So if I'm going to be someplace very short term, you know, I'm definitely going to rent. If I'm going to be somewhere longer term, I'm going to rent based upon what I think the price is in the market and whether or not that's sustainable. So that's a hard one to say. For me, I'd like to buy. I would want to buy. My inclination is to buy, but I won't if the price isn't reasonable.
Mm-hmm. And you know, do you think we're entering sort of a new era where, you know, you keep hearing about the millennials are less interested in buying? They want to be more mobile. They want to live closer to mass transit, more in city centers. Do you think they'll eventually, you know, replicate kind of what other generations have done by, you know, eventually getting houses, having kids? Or do you think this is maybe a new reality?
I don't think it's a new reality. I think the millennials will follow a similar path that we do. They'll do it their way. They'll do it differently. But
they'll have beards when they do it.
They'll have beards when they do it. I honestly think, you know, there's stability in buying, and I think if they can make it work, they're going to want to buy, especially when you start having kids. It gets it gets more difficult to, you know, move from place to place. And if you're renting, that is the, you know, the biggest downside to renting is you can be kicked out of your home at some point in time, unless you're like some rent controlled place. But I don't know. I don't think the urge to want to own something, especially where you're living, is ever going to go away. It's almost built into our DNA. So if they can do it, I think they will.
You know, occasionally you hear this idea of, you know, let's get away with the mortgage deduction. And that would, of course, make purchasing a little less appealing. Again, this could be a topic for another podcast. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, you see these proposals floated and then they disappear. Do you think we could ever see a time where maybe they dial back some of the, you know, tax advantages of home ownership?
Yeah. Although I think it would have to be done in a way that's thoughtful. I mean, we definitely the tax advantages that go with a home are definitely skewed towards the more well off, the upper middle class, and the wealthy. So I could see the the mortgage deduction being smaller. You can't deduct all of your mortgage interest, you know. So anything over, say, $500,000, mortgage interest is not deductible, you know, something like those. So I can see some tweaks to it, but what we have gone through with the last financial crisis, when the first time we ever saw home prices go down in this country, the entire world fell apart. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're going to see something that is going to potentially undermine the housing market, at least right now. Not until we've forgotten the financial crisis, which it kind of feels like we have in some ways, but not until we've really forgotten the housing crisis will we put into place policies that could potentially undermine housing.
So we've got that to look forward to.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, your turn.
Okay, the original Star Wars or the more recent version of Star Wars with Jar Jar Binks?
I've got to say original. You know, I just, I'm all for, like, you know, like Better Call Saul, you know, a prequel, but I don't know. These just seem out of control, what's happening with Star Wars. And I guess if you're a huge fan, that's just great, right? I guess I'm a little bit of a hypocrite being a Breaking Bad fan. I love that they now have this prequel, but you know, I forget which one I went to at one of the newer Star Wars with my son, and I just frankly could not wait for it to end. It was just not appealing. So who knows? Maybe these new ones will be great, but I'm definitely predisposed to the original Star Wars. How about you?
I love the original Star Wars. I always will. I did not like the three prequels. I didn't think they were very good. Revenge of the Sith was probably my favorite of the three, but I am looking forward to the new ones with I think JJ. I like JJ Abrams. I think he's a good storyteller, and he's doing away with a lot of the CGI that they brought into the last one. So I think it'll be a different feel. I'm hoping it will be. I don't know if you saw the latest trailer for it. It looked fantastic.
Okay, well, I would be willing to give that a try, one of these newer versions here. All right, Scott, so my turn, Honda or Toyota?
It's funny, I almost said American cars or foreign cars. That was going to be one of my questions. I didn't want to get you in trouble, though. Well, I own a Toyota, and I've owned a Honda. I would say Honda if I was buying a minivan. Toyota if... I'm being very indecisive here. I'll go Toyota.
Okay.
The Prius and all that. I'll go with Toyota.
Okay. I have one of each. We have a Honda minivan, the Odyssey, with the license plate Odyssey. You know, play on my last name, Otter there. And then we have a Toyota Prius. And I got to say, I love the Prius. I love both cars. They each have a great, they're very good at what they're supposed to do. I love, you know, family trips in the minivan. And for running around town, the Prius is fantastic. My only issue with Toyota is when we were looking at vans, we looked at Toyota vans, and they just had too many options. You know, Honda is very simple. It's almost like a target date fund, which we can, again, get into what that means in future podcasts. But it's very simple. Basically, two or three models. You know, I like that kind of choice as opposed to, you know, just an excess of choice, which, again, a little bit like variable annuity products, right? If it's too complex, I think you got to go the other way.
I agree. All right, is it my turn?
It's your turn. Last question.
Last question. Okay, here we go. It's a little staid, but red wine or white wine?
That's actually a very good question because I get this question all the time. I love everything about red wine except for the next morning. I am one of those people that gets headaches in the morning, and every time I'm like, why did I do that? I love the taste of red wine. It goes well with so much food. But for me, it's the morning after. So I have to unfortunately say white wine. That's kind of embarrassing to admit.
I'm a red wine guy too. I just drink a lot of water while I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good policy. Well, all right, Scott, well, we wrap this thing up, but I'd like to add one more little feature here. I call it something we like. Is there anything during this past week, and we're recording this on April 17th, 2015, anything that you kind of came across? Could be a new TV show, a new app, a new investment product, a John Oliver bit, a book, something you kind of discovered or found interesting this week that you want to share.
I really hadn't had a lot of time to think about it. I think the so I'm gonna buy the Apple Watch, but I didn't discover that this week. So I'm gonna go with a different one. I didn't really discover it this week, but it's kind of cool, and I have enough Amazon gift cards for my birthday that I think I might buy it. But the Kevo Quick Set door lock kit. Basically, just by walking up to your door, it'll pair with your phone and it'll automatically open up for you. So your front door. So you can basically control access to your house through your smartphone and Bluetooth. And if you were at my house and I was somewhere else, I could send you a key basically through the phone, and your phone would just get you into my house.
Gosh, I've been waiting for this product. I've got the keyless entry for my Prius. I just love the idea of just walking up to the car. It opens up. It seems like when you think of products like Nest, for the home, that this is the next logical step. So this is a pretty easy conversion for existing doors then.
It looks exactly like the current Quick Set. It's the exact
Okay.
same size. It looks exactly the same. You just replace it, and I don't know if it's that easy because I haven't put it together yet, but it looks pretty simple and kind of cool. I love that techie stuff.
Oh, that's something a great product. Well, I'm going to go with John Oliver. I'm a huge fan of his. I like his show. I loved his bit on our misplaced anger at the IRS. We love to rant and rage at the IRS, but it's like that old saying, don't shoot the messenger. It's just these are people who are just executing the insane, often insane decisions of Congress, which have built up over decades. And I think on tax day, I hate when cable news networks are, talking about how horrific the day is because of, the IRS. But if you haven't listened to him yet or seen the bit, just Google it. I have it actually. It's the main story on 403BYs. Not quite sure when we're going to upload these podcasts, but I will have it in our news archive. But just Google John Oliver plus IRS, and there's a great cameo by Michael Bolton, which
That's
makes
right.
the whole thing. I don't know if you remember that. That makes the whole thing
I
worthwhile. Just fantastic. So,
do.
Scott, any last words?
Oh boy, I hope they're not my last words. No, and I love doing these podcasts with you. I think we got a lot of good information that we're going to come out with over the coming months. This is good. I like it. It's
I
fun.
agree. Hey, Scott, you were just fantastic today. Lots of fantastic information about pension plans. So, Scott, look forward to hooking up with you next week. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Talk to you soon, man. Thanks.